Good day. Today is Tuesday, 10th March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched or listened to this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, over the last 24 hours, we have seen a whole spate of contradictory messages and signals coming from the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and perhaps from members of his administration, which cumulatively do seem to suggest growing doubts about the progress of the military operation against Iran, and perhaps the first steps towards seeking some kind of off-ramp. One needs to be extremely careful what one says about all of this, however, because one also gets messages which still seem to imply a decision to seek further escalation. Of course, the two are not necessarily in contradiction. It might be the case that the president and his officials have begun to understand that the situation is not going according to plan at all, that they are looking for an off-ramp. They may sense the political and economic damage that the war is causing, but as many people who find themselves in that kind of situation often do, they respond at the same time by escalating, by attempting to change the situation to their advantage, even as they try to look for a way out. Now, we had a whole cascade of comments and statements yesterday, many of them from the president himself. And of course, the background to these comments was the surge in oil prices that I discussed yesterday. And well, there was that report, which I also discussed yesterday in the Financial Times, about the G7 states releasing oil from their strategic reserves. President Macron of France then subsequently came out with a statement saying that no decision to do anything of that kind had in fact been made. But for several hours, there were lots of reports about releasing oil from the strategic reserves. I've seen two articles, one in Euro Intelligence and one in the Financial Times, which both suggested that releasing oil from the reserves might not actually have the long-term effect on pushing down oil prices that perhaps the president and his officials might hope, that the benefit of a release of oil from the reserves would be only short-term, that eventually the reserves would have to be built up again, which would mean taking oil from the market, not returning it to the market, which might in time actually put upward pressure on prices. The article in Euro Intelligence also made the point that when talking about the strategic reserves of the G7, there are differences between the various G7 states. In some cases, such as France, the entire strategic reserve is held nationally by the French government. In other countries, and Euro Intelligence didn't name them, but in other countries, it is a mix with some of the reserves held by the government, but other reserves held by industry and by private companies, and they might be less willing to release any part of their reserves. And anyway, the Euro Intelligence article made the further point that there are anyway legal limits to how much oil can be released from the strategic reserves in all of the G7 countries. There is apparently a legal obligation to retain at least 90 days of oil, 90 days of usage of oil in the reserves to cover major emergencies such as a war, a natural disaster, things of that kind, and that the fact that the price of oil has reached a certain level is not in accordance with these laws, the enough in itself or sufficient cause in itself to deplete these reserves beyond a certain level. I discussed this whole topic at length yesterday. I'm not going to repeat what I said. All I would say again is that if we do get into a crisis situation where there is going to be a major depletion of reserves, then inevitably countries are going to hold on to what reserves they have. There will be reluctance to share oil from the reserves, and that might create a whole further set of problems. So tapping the reserves is not a long-term solution to the crisis. And in fact, it became increasingly clear yesterday that faced by what looked like an inexorably rising oil price, much of the president's response was in effect declaratory, saying again that the conflict with Iran, which has already continued for around 10 days, that it's going to be a short one. He spoke about how the United States is ahead of its timetable in the war. But then, of course, as he's never released the timetable, we've no way of confirming that. And for the record, I don't believe him when he says this. He also said that the war itself was like a little excursion. Again, trying to play down its scale, despite the fact that apparently half the available US Air Force and a third of the US Navy has been committed to the war, a commitment which may increase once the third carrier, the George H.W. Bush, arrives on the scene. But anyway, he said it was all a little excursion. He also said that 90% or something like that of the objectives had already been achieved. The Iranian Navy, which of course was never a major part of Iran's military. Anyway, that the Iranian military has now been sunk, mostly. About that, by the way, he is mostly telling the truth. That the rest of the Iranian military has been badly defeated, and that Iran's political system, its political leadership, has been destroyed. Although self-evidently it has not been destroyed, Iran has a new supreme leader, Khamenei the Second. Pezeshkian, the president, is still alive. And all of the military leaders who were killed together with the previous supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, appear to have been replaced. So anyway, the president said all of those things. And it's clear that the reports about release of oil from the strategic reserves and all of these reassurances from the president that the war would end soon, that all of these things did have some reassurance effect on global energy markets. The price of oil yesterday slipped below $100 a barrel, and I believe it is currently trading closer to $90 a barrel. still significantly above where it was before the start of the war, but perhaps not quite at the catastrophic levels that we saw briefly yesterday. Having said that, declarations that the war will be short, talk about releasing oil from reserves, the reserves, all of those things can only have an effect for a short time. Somehow or other, in some way or other, something more decisive needs to happen in order to turn the situation around. And the president again had more to say about this. He was complaining about the fact that the crews of the tankers in the Persian Gulf seemed to lack courage and seemed unwilling to brave the Straits of Hormuz. I understand, by the way, that one tanker did attempt to do that this morning, but was attacked by drones of the IRGC and has apparently suffered significant damage. But the reports for the moment are unclear, and I'm not exactly sure what happened. The administration has apparently cobbled together a plan to cover the insurance costs of tankers in the Persian Gulf that want to risk the Straits of Hormuz. The total amount in this insurance fund, which as far as I'm aware has up to now had no takers, is $20 billion or so, I believe. I don't think that is anywhere near enough for the kind of risks that these tankers would face. And anyway, there are still lots of uncertainties about this scheme, which to my knowledge has not yet received congressional approval and may never will, though I presume that under US law it would need to. Anyway, I don't think this amount of $20 billion in this fund is anywhere near close to being big enough to give assurance to ship owners, even if the crews themselves were prepared to risk their lives by trying to pass through the Straits of Hormuz. In any event, the Straits of Hormuz, as of the time of making this programme, continue to remain closed. The IRGC continues to play cat and mouse over this issue. They sometimes talk about granting licenses to tankers to pass through, but the way in which these licenses would be granted remains extraordinarily vague. And, well, the IRGC yesterday apparently floated an offer that tankers of countries which ended diplomatic relations with Israel and the United States would be able to pass the Straits of Hormuz. Another astonishing declaratory statement, which obviously has no meaning, because I cannot imagine that any countries that have diplomatic relations with those two countries, Israel and the United States, would be prepared to take that step, even in order to get the Straits of Hormuz unblocked. And, well, there continues to be a lot of chatter in the media and from some Western officials about some kind of operation, military operation, to open the Straits of Hormuz. President Macron of France, who never balks at the opportunity to put French military personnel in danger, was talking about this extensively. He talked about some kind of operation by France and other countries, a defensive operation, as he called it, to secure freedom of navigation in the Eastern Mediterranean and in all sorts of places. But he threw in the Gulf of Hormuz for good measure. And he is indeed busy deploying the French fleet, such as it is, in ways that might imply that it too will be part of this operation. The British government, with a fleet in considerably worse shape than the French, by the way, appears to be reconsidering the idea of deploying one of its carriers to this operation. But anyway, let's not waste time with what the French and the British might do. The only country that has the means to deploy forces to the Straits of Hormuz, which might conceivably be able to break the Iranian blockade, is the United States. And, well, it seems to me that this is a very problematic military operation, even for the United States itself. Simplicius the Thinker has written a fine article on his Substack site discussing why it is actually exceptionally difficult for Iran to sink US Navy carriers. He makes in this article, but in much more detail, some of the points I have seen, and indeed made myself, about how carriers are constantly moving maneuverable targets, how ballistic missiles, or indeed ship cruise missiles launched at these targets would find them difficult to attack, because in the case of ballistic missiles do not generally strike targets. They do not have radar homing. They do not carry radar homing to attack moving targets. The only country that is known to have that capability at the moment that has anti-ship ballistic missiles on land with radar homing is China. Iran does not have that capability at the moment. So a missile launched from Iran towards where Iran believes the carrier to be might quite easily, in fact, would most likely find that the expensive missile might miss the carrier. And Simplicius the Thinker also discusses how cruise missiles, even very, very fast cruise missiles launched against carriers, would also be unlikely to find the carriers because they will have moved before the cruise missiles arrive, and the cruise missiles anyway would probably be vulnerable to shooting down by the anti-aircraft and missiles of the carriers escorting destroyers. It was a very interesting article, one which actually bears reading, and which I think might allay many of the questions and doubts that many people have about this question. I think I can summarise it by saying that a successful attack on a carrier by Iran at the present time would be basically a lucky hit, a very unlikely lucky hit. And this is in part because anyway, the United States Navy is careful to deploy its carriers and its other warships in open seas, a significant distance from Iran itself. That obviously limits the capabilities of the carriers to conduct airstrikes against Iran because of the distance the aircraft would have to cover. But at the same time, it does make it very, very difficult, all but impossible, in fact, for Iran to attack those carriers. But if there is an operation to open the Straits of Hormuz, then US warships would have to position themselves very much closer to the Iranian coastline. In fact, if we're talking about the Straits of Hormuz, within visual distance in some cases of the Iranian coastline, they would have far less maneuver space. They would become easy targets, or much easier targets, for Iranian drone and missile strikes. Damage would be done. Air defense systems would be rapidly depleted. There will be significant vulnerability to sea mines, which the Iranians used in the 1980s, and that capability and skill they undoubtedly still have. And well, this would be a massively problematic operation, and one which I get the sense the US Navy is not keen to embark upon at all. For the record, I think that any operation to unblock the Straits of Hormuz, whilst the war is ongoing, is so dangerous, so high risk, that I don't personally think that the United States is going to attempt it at all. I've seen all sorts of reports and claims about this, but frankly, I don't think it's going to happen. Just saying. So, for the moment, the Straits of Hormuz remain closed. Shipping from the Persian Gulf remains impossible. And, well, adding to the president's problems, adding to the problems that the global economy is facing, is the fact that Persian Gulf producers, the Gulf states, are increasingly under increasing pressure. Their storage tanks are becoming filled. Their ability to export oil is reducing. Bahrain yesterday followed Qatar by declaring force majeure. Sooner or later, the other Gulf states are bound to do the same. And today, Saudi Aramco, the oil company, the state oil company of Saudi Arabia, responsible for Saudi Arabia's oil exports, talked about a catastrophic situation in global energy markets if the war continued for much longer and if the Straits of Hormuz remained closed. Now, Aramco did also say that they are trying to divert more of Saudi Arabia's oil exports to the Red Sea ports. They believe that within a few days they will be able to export 70% of Saudi Arabia's production through the Red Sea. Perhaps, I have no reason to doubt that they can do that, but again, a 30% reduction in Saudi export of oil combined with a stop in exports by Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, and the UAE, remains a catastrophic decline in the amount of Persian Gulf oil that is reaching world energy markets. And Saudi Aramco were careful to say that. So, if the Straits of Hormuz cannot be forced open, if, as appears to be the case, the political situation in Iran remains stable, if more military pressure on Iran is not going to change that position anytime soon, what does the United States, what does the president do? He's, of course, floated the possibility in the past about an incursion by the Kurds in Western Iran. Then he seemed to walk that back. And we've seen reports that the Kurds themselves are very, very sceptical and doubtful of an operation of that kind. We've had reports that the 82nd Airborne Division is going to be transferred to the Middle East, and we've seen suggestions about some kind of military operation to seize Harg Island, Iran's major oil terminal. Well, that would be a very, very complex operation in itself, one carrying its own set of risks. I'm not sure anyway how it solves the overall problem in terms of the Straits of Hormuz. And besides, an operation like that, not just seizing Harg Island, but consolidating control of it, securing control of it, might in itself take some time and might lead to further escalation and might start creating further concern and crisis in world energy markets. And beneath it all, behind it all, we have the continuous tension, the problems being created by the fact that all reports now speak of weapon stocks running low, precision-guided weapon stocks running low. There was a report yesterday that there are large numbers of flights of aircraft to Israel to replenish Israeli arsenals of weapons, which, by the way, also suggests that the drawdown of weapons in Israel has been very, very fast, so that Israel is having to turn, presumably, to the United States urgently for further supplies. Well, there's this concern, and for the moment at least, Iran continues to conduct its counterstrikes against Israel, against American bases across the Middle East, and across a range of targets using its drones and its ballistic missiles. The Iranians, incidentally, are saying that the effectiveness of their drone and missile strikes has been such that the United States has had to empty its bases of personnel, that it's had to pull its fleet 1,000 kilometres from the Iranian coast, and that it is having to redeploy many of the personnel, the US personnel who used to staff the US bases, to hotel buildings across the Gulf states. And that this is why Iran is currently attacking those hotel buildings. This is an Iranian claim. I don't know whether or not it is true. It may be true. It wouldn't surprise me if it is. But then this is a war. The parties to a war say many things. One can't be sure unless one knows whether what is said is true. What the Iranians are also saying is that no one should read anything into the fact that there has been a reduction in drone and missile strikes. Iran is able to continue to conduct drone strikes. And now, instead of using thousands of smaller missiles, as it did in the opening days of the war, because of the depletion of US and Israeli and Gulf Arab missile arsenals, and because of the mass destruction of American radar systems that took place in the first days of the war, Iran can be more selective in the targets that it strikes, and it doesn't have to worry about many of its missiles and drones being intercepted. And for that reason, it is now using bigger, more powerful ballistic missiles to attack targets, and it's shown pictures of it doing so. And it says that the more advanced hypersonic missiles are still being held back and have not been used. And at least one of the films that I saw did appear to suggest that one of these bigger missiles was being launched not from a mobile launcher, which the United States claims that it has destroyed in large numbers, that it has destroyed them in large numbers, but it seemed as if this missile had been launched from some kind of ground silo, basically a hole in the ground, the bunker, presumably a bunker beneath the hole, the missiles kept there and maybe launched through the silo. Again, I am not going to discuss the technology of this, which is, again, not my thing. But maybe there are large numbers of Iranian missiles hidden away underground in this way. Maybe there are large numbers of silos that Iran has. Maybe, as the Iranians also say, most of the ground launchers that the Israelis and the Americans think that they've destroyed are decoys. I don't know and have no information, no independent information about any of these things. But again, it remains the case that the Iranians are continuing to conduct strikes, and they do seem to be using more powerful missiles. And it does seem that the Americans and the Israelis have less ability to intercept them. And of course, if you believe Professor Postol, who, by the way, I mostly do, maybe they don't have that ability to intercept these missiles, these ballistic missiles, at all. I've noticed, by the way, that one prominent actor in this drama, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, seems to have practically disappeared from sight. He's saying very little, and I think over the last few days, nothing at all. He's leaving it to the president to say all that needs to be said, all that is being said. And maybe a possible reason why we are hearing so much less from Prime Minister Netanyahu is because he also understands that this operation is not going well, and that things are happening, such as the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, the crisis in the energy markets, the destruction of the American radar systems across the Middle East, the continued strikes on Israel and across the Middle East by Iran with its heavy missiles and its drones, which he did not anticipate and which perhaps he reassured the president would not happen. But then that brings us back to the president himself. He's told people yesterday that the war would be short, that it was a short excursion, that it would be over very soon, that most of the objectives had originally been achieved. Well, to me, and I think in the energy markets, it starts to look as if at least one part of the president's mind is starting to turn to the possibility of looking for an off-ramp, of trying to find some means to extricate himself and the United States from this war, which has gone terribly, horribly wrong. And, well, we've had reports from the Wall Street Journal that there are officials within the US administration who are now advising the president that this has gone as far as it can go and that the war needs to end. And interestingly, there have been identical reports in Israel itself that there are Israeli officials who are worrying about whether an open-ended war comes with disastrous consequences for the global economy, but also perhaps more pressingly for Donald Trump's political position in the United States. The calculation apparently being that Israel cannot afford the political implosion of a US president because he stood by and supported Israel. Just saying. So we are starting to see signs that perhaps the president and at least some of his officials, even whilst they continue to talk about continuing the war, might be looking for some sort of off-ramp. And yesterday, the single most important thing that points in that direction duly took place. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, picked up the phone and telephoned Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Now, the Russians, as is their way, have now published a very detailed briefing about this conversation, and it has been provided by Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov. And I'm going to read it in full, and then I'm going to make a few comments about it. This is what Ushakov said yesterday at 20:22:30 Moscow time. This evening, notice it happened in the evening, this evening a conversation took place between the presidents of Russia and the United States. Donald Trump telephoned Vladimir Putin to discuss a number of highly important issues related to the current international situation. So the Russians are saying clearly, without any ambiguity, without any doubt, that it was Trump who called Putin. It was Trump who initiated the call and called Putin. I've discussed in many programs how in a readout of telephone conversations between governments, when a government confirms that it was the other side that sought the call, what the government that publishes the fact is telling us is that the government that initiated the call came begging. And that clearly is what happened in this call between Trump and Putin. Trump called Putin because he wants Putin's help. And then Ushakov continues, naturally, particular attention was given to the situation surrounding the conflict with Iran, as well as the ongoing trilateral negotiations on the Ukrainian settlement involving representatives of the United States. Note the order. First Iran, then Ukraine. For the first time since Putin and Trump have been speaking to each other, Ukraine is not the topic highest on the agenda. This time, the topic highest on the agenda is Iran. By the way, on that point, Zelensky himself is extremely unhappy about this. He said yesterday that there'd been an agreement between the Americans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians, that today there should be more talks, a continuation of the trilateral talks, that they were supposed to happen in Istanbul. Remember, Zelensky has been very hostile to the talks up to now. He's always resisted holding the talks. He didn't want these talks to happen at all. Back in the autumn of 2025, in November 2025, he said that the bilateral negotiations between Russia and Ukraine were completely called off. Now, however, he is complaining that the Americans and the Russians postponed the talks in Istanbul that were supposed to take place today. So he's not happy. Previously, he wasn't happy that the talks were happening. Now he's not happy because the talks are being postponed. The reason he is not happy is because he senses that the Americans are losing interest in Ukraine, that they're not supplying Ukraine with the weapons that Ukraine needs and wants, and because, as we will see, the Russians are now starting to gain leverage over the Americans because the Americans have got themselves into a mess over Iran. Anyway, going back to Ushakov, it is Iran that was the main topic of discussion in the call between Trump and Putin yesterday. And then Ushakov goes on to say this: I would note at the outset that the conversation was businesslike, frank, and constructive, as is typically the case in dialogue between the Russian and American leaders. Businesslike, frank. Now, no words here about the conversation between being sincere, which is, or warm, both adjectives to discuss conversations between Putin and Trump, which Ushakov has used in the past. Instead, we have businesslike and Frank. And as I and several others, notably Larry Johnson, have pointed out, the word Frank can often be taken to mean, in Russian readouts and descriptions of these kind of conversations, that the conversation was contentious, perhaps even heated at times. Well, I would add, I would say that in relation to this particular conversation, referring to the meeting as frank and businesslike rather does suggest that. It suggests that this was a contentious call altogether. There were clearly disagreements and pushback and perhaps argument. It's not inconceivable that the conversation was at times heated. It is interesting that Ushakov now says that this is becoming typical of the conversations between Trump and Putin, which suggests that the bromance that was characteristic of their earlier calls and of the Alaska meeting has now completely gone away, just saying. But Ushakov does nonetheless tell us that the meeting was constructive. And then he reminds us of something else. They, Putin and Trump, had not spoken by telephone for quite some time. Their previous conversation took place at the end of December 2025. I have been making that point in many, many programs. In fact, there has been no conversations between Putin and Trump since that telephone call on the 29th of December 2025, or to be more precise, two conversations that took place in December on the 29th of December 2025. And as we know, what happened between those two conversations that took place on the 29th of December 2025 was that Ukraine carried out a drone attack on Novgorod, on Novgorod region in Russia. As the Russians say, and as I have no doubt took place on Putin's Valdai residence. The Russians have not wanted to talk to Trump, or at least have made no effort to talk to Trump since that meeting, since that conversation, when the Russians clearly feel an attempt was made to attack the building where the Americans and the Ukrainians probably thought Putin was located. Almost certainly, in the case of the Ukrainians, with the intention of killing him. So, Ushakov is again careful to remind us of this. He is reminding us of not just of the fact that the call took place a while ago, but he's also implicitly reminding us of what took place during that call, and by implication again, of the reasons why following those events on the 29th of December of 2025, the Russian and American presidents have not spoken to each other up to now since. And then Ushakov tells us something else. Today's call, incidentally, lasted about an hour. A long call in general, I mean, if leaders speak to each other for an hour by phone, then that is usually a long call, but not in the case of the interactions between Putin and Trump. By their standards, this was a relatively short call. A short call, Ushakov says, was frank, constructive, and businesslike. A rather contentious call, a call over which there was clearly disagreement. But anyway, he then tells us this. The US president noted that, as previously agreed, such contact should take place on a regular basis, and both leaders confirmed that they are ready for this. In other words, Trump complained to Putin that Putin, up to now, ever since December, has not been willing to speak to him. That's my interpretation of these words. But isn't it the obvious one? And Trump says, please, when I call you, please speak to me from now on. We do need to remain in touch. And Putin said, okay, we should. Anyway, then Ushakov says this. The president of Russia set out a number of considerations aimed at achieving a prompt political and diplomatic settlement of the Iranian conflict, including in light of the contacts he has recently held with leaders of the Gulf states, with President of Iran, Masoud Pezeshkian, and with the leaders of several other countries. So, Putin is telling Trump, this war is a terrible mistake. We know that Putin thinks this because he's referred to it as an act of aggression against Iran. The Russians have issued public statements condemning this attack, saying that it's appalling that it took place in the midst of negotiations. Putin messaged Pezeshkian saying that the killing of Khamenei was an appalling, immoral, illegal, and cynical act. So there is no doubt what Putin thinks about this war. There is no doubt that the Russians have taken Iran's side in this war. The Russian ambassador to Britain said so quite explicitly. He said that Russia is not neutral in this conflict. It is on Iran's side. And of course, we've seen many reports, which I believe to be true, and which, in fact, I am certain are true based on information I have received, that the Russians have been providing intelligence to Iran. So Putin will have told Trump all of these things, that Russia supports Iran, that it is on Iran's side, that the attack on Iran was totally unjustified, that it was aggression. But Putin will also have told Trump something else. I am in touch with the Iranians. I am in touch with the Arab Gulf states. I am in a position to mediate between you and them, and I have ideas about how this conflict can be ended if you are looking for an off-ramp. And unlike you, I can talk to the Iranians about them, and I can talk to the Gulf states. And if it is indeed an off-ramp that you are seeking, I might be able to provide it. And going back to Ushakov's briefing, we see that Ushakov said that Putin set out a number of considerations aimed at achieving a prompt political and diplomatic settlement of the Iranian conflict. Notice that the briefing speaks of considerations rather than proposals. That, of course, is exactly what a mediator is supposed to do. Mediators are not supposed to be in the business of setting up proposals, just saying. But anyway, when Putin talks about considerations, it is probably proposals that he actually means. And then we go on to read, for his part, the US president shared his assessment of developments in the context of the ongoing US-Israeli operation. In other words, Trump provided Putin with some kind of military update, And then Ushakov says, I would note that a very substantive and, I believe, exchange of views took place on this matter. So no agreements were reached, no commonality of positions was reached. When we hear about an exchange of views, again, that suggests that the discussion was contentious, but the Russians still think it was useful, probably because they were able to explain their opposition to this whole conflict to Trump and put him in no possible doubt about that, but perhaps because they also signaled to Trump that, as I said, if he was looking for an off-ramp, the Russians might indeed be in a position to provide it. And then we have the afterthought. President Trump once again expressed interest in bringing the conflict in Ukraine to an end as soon as possible by achieving a ceasefire that would open the way to a long-term settlement. So Trump is again talking about a ceasefire, which of course the Russians have rejected. Notice that the readout, the briefing, does not say that Putin agreed with this. On the contrary, what Putin is reported to have said in response was that on our side, a positive assessment was given of the mediation efforts undertaken by Trump team and by him personally. An assessment, however, was also provided of the current situation along the line of contact where Russian forces are advancing successfully. As was noted, this is a factor that should compel the Kiev regime to finally move towards a negotiated settlement of the conflict. So the Russians are not budging. They're not in the mood for ceasefires or anything of that kind. They said to Trump, look, unlike you with Iran, we are actually winning our war. It is for the Ukrainians and ultimately for you to move towards our position. We're not here to make any compromises, but I doubt that Ukraine was discussed very much. And interestingly, we're then told that the leaders also touched upon the issue of Venezuela, primarily in the context of the situation on the global oil market. I suspect it was Putin who brought up Venezuela and may have said something to Trump about disruptions in the oil markets being largely caused by Trump's actions. And then Ushakov's briefing finishes. Overall, I would reiterate that the conversation was highly substantive. In other words, it dealt with the material issues and will undoubtedly have practical significance for further cooperation between our two countries across various areas of international policy, which again stops well short of saying that there was any actual agreement on the and that the and or that there was any warmth or sincerity or positive outcome to the discussions. But it does say that what happens next, whether there is going to be a resolution of the conflict in Iran, whether there is indeed going to be any progress on Ukraine, that is all going to weigh in future on the question of whether US-Russian relations can improve. So, coming back to what I was saying, that this call was clearly Trump's attempt to get Putin's help to try to find an off-ramp. When we pass Ushakov's briefing, we can clearly see that this is so. Putin, however, was in an extremely tough mood. He made it very, very clear to Trump that he thinks the entire approach taken towards Iran is disastrously wrong. And basically he said to Trump, look, if you want my help in getting an off-ramp in this crisis, an end to the war, which is causing all this crisis in the energy markets, well, I am prepared to the extent that I can to give that help. Though nowhere in the briefing do the Russians guarantee a successful outcome. They undoubtedly know how difficult it is going to be to persuade the Iranians to agree to anything, just say. But the Russians said that, yes, they will be prepared to offer that help, but it will have to be on terms that fall far short of Trump's objectives, regime change in Iran, and the total disarmament of Iran. Now, what might the Russians suggest? Well, it is actually not very difficult to work out. The Russians will suggest a return to the proposals that have been made on enrichment, and which the Iranians, by the way, previously showed willingness to agree to, the setting up of the consortium, the ending of enrichment to 60% levels, Rosatom's involvement on it, the strong safeguards to ensure it. The Russians undoubtedly were prepared to offer those things, but they will also insist on other things, undertakings that there will be no further attacks on Iran in the future, undertakings from the Americans. The Russians know perfectly well that the Iranians will not accept those undertakings. What I suspect the Russians will nonetheless do is that they will come to the Iranians and they will say, look, you've made your point, you've demonstrated your ability to defend yourselves. You've come out of this conflict the overall winners. You've shown that you can close the Straits of Hormuz, that you can attack American targets across the Middle East. The moment now has come for you to stop whilst you are ahead. Obviously, you can't trust the Americans. We're not expecting you to trust the Americans. We don't trust the Americans either. The whole tone of this briefing by Ushakov says that as well. As I said, no suggestions of sincerity, of honesty, of warmth or anything of that kind. It's instead all about frankness and businesslike and exchange of views. It's that kind of language that is not the language of trust between leaders. Anyway, the Russians will be telling the Iranians, we don't trust the Americans either. But after the battering, the Americans, their Gulf allies, and by the way, the Israelis have suffered. If you come through this intact, as we can guarantee you will, then rest assured, we will do all we can, provided you agree to make sure that next time you are more secure. We can move forward with that security partnership that we discussed when we were negotiating the partnership agreement that we signed off and ratified last year. You balked at moving forward with that. We might move forward with that. We will certainly move forward with weapons deliveries to you. We might even send some of our own personnel there. And perhaps the Chinese will join us in doing that also. You've seen that we've provided you with intelligence assistance. Next time, if the Americans in a year or two are ready to attack you again, they will know that this time you are much stronger than you have been before. So the Russians might say all of these things. The Chinese might say all of these things. And the Russians will also remind the Iranians that the Russians are talking to the Gulf states. They have advised the Gulf states strongly against going to war themselves with Iran. It seems that the Gulf states are taking that advice. They've also indicated that they don't intend to join the coalition against Iran. Senator Lindsey Graham is furious about this, and he's now threatening Saudi Arabia, incredibly, because Saudi Arabia won't attack Iran. The Russians might say that if Iran agrees to some kind of off-ramp, to some kind of negotiated resolution, then Russia will move forward with the Gulf states to create some kind of security system in the Gulf, which will possibly preclude further military action against Iran. Now, I don't know whether the Iranians would accept that. I don't know whether the Supreme Leader, the new Supreme Leader, whose father has been killed, along with other members of his immediate family, would be prepared to agree to that. I don't know whether the IRGC would be prepared to agree to that either. I suspect it would be a very tough sell in Iran. I suspect that the guarantees Iran would have to receive would need to be very, very strong to get them to agree. But at least it is a potential way forward. The big question is Donald Trump, are the Americans, are the Israelis prepared to take it? This war has not gone well for them up to this time. Perhaps a sense of realism is growing. The report in the Wall Street Journal about US officials advising that the time has come to look for an exit strategy. The reports from Israel about discussions in Israel also about looking for a way out of the war. The reports, the comments made by the president himself suggest the same thing. But, well, at this moment in time, it's far from clear either that the Iranians are prepared for an exit ramp, or that Donald Trump and the people around him in Washington are. Some people, Lindsey Graham, for example, will never be. They will be furious if the war ends with the present government in Iran still in place, and with Iran having refused to make any of the substantive concessions on ballistic missiles, on changing its foreign policy, these impossible, unreasonable demands that the United States and Israel were making on the eve of the war. So the gulf between the two sides is enormous. But all I will say is, if there is any individual who might be in a position to put the pieces back together, then it is Vladimir Putin. I cannot at this time think of anyone else. Now, of course, oil prices have been rising. Putin chaired another big meeting yesterday, in which he talked about the importance of Russia ending further energy supplies to Europe. He was careful to make clear that countries in Europe which have been reliable customers, like Slovakia and Hungary, and I would add Yugoslavia, obviously that they will continue to receive the supplies that they need from Russia. But the various other unfriendly countries, the European Union, Britain, they will not receive such supplies. He also spoke about the importance for Russia of developing its new markets in Asia. I expect the Russians to announce this decision very soon, that they're ending supplies of energy to Europe. I also think that this is going to be an enormous crisis for the Europeans. Even if Russian mediation is successful and the fighting ends and the Straits of Hormuz are reopened, even if that happens soon, even if that happens without Russian mediation, even if the Iranian government collapses and all of these steps happen within the next couple of days, tomorrow even, it will take weeks or months before Qatar can resume LNG exports with a cessation of Russian LNG exports to Europe. it's difficult to see how, despite continued American supplies, which would come at a major spike in costs, with the Europeans having to compete for American supplies against Asian customers and perhaps against customers in the United States itself, it's difficult to imagine that Putin's decision to stop energy supplies to Europe is not going to come with a major crisis for European economies, especially as demand for gas and oil starts to rise in the autumn. But nonetheless, we see that despite the fact that the high oil prices, the high energy prices, are a benefit for Russia, the Russians nonetheless are prepared to act to end the war as soon as possible, despite the fact that it is the war in the Middle East, in Iran, which is leading to the high energy prices. This again is consistent with Russian strategic thinking. It is more important for them to secure long-term stability on their borders, in this case, their southern borders, than to take advantage of temporary increases in energy prices. The fall in energy prices last year has undoubtedly pushed their budget into higher deficit than it would otherwise be, but it is something they can cope with. A crisis on their southern borders caused by a collapse of Iran or a prolonged war involving in Iran is far more dangerous to their long-term future and fully outsets any temporary benefit that they might get from oil, higher oil prices. That, at least, is the Russians' calculation. Now, it has to be said that President Trump, and this should be taken as another clear sign that he's looking for an off-ramp and is extremely worried about the situation in global energy prices. Anyway, President Trump and his officials have now been talking about relaxing, some say ending, all sanctions on Russia's oil export trade. Understanding that this oil export trade is essential for general stability in global energy prices, which is in turn essential for the long-term stability of the US economy. Now, it must be said that apart from the untrue announcement that it is only because of American permission that India is now resume buying large amounts of Russian oil, as the Indians themselves have now said, they never stopped buying Russian oil. American claims to the contrary are simply not true. Anyway, apart from that announcement, there's been no visible sign up to this moment that any of the energy sanctions, any of the oil sanctions against Russia have actually been eased by the United States. If it does happen, then obviously, it will have a global economic effect. It will lead to lower energy prices, which will be beneficial for the United States and obviously for Russia, or rather Russia's ability to export will be beneficial to Russia, but it will lead to lower energy prices overall, which, by the way, will offer some relief to European consumers as well. Just saying. But it would be, even more than that, a step of enormous symbolic significance. It would mean an acknowledgement that the economic war that the West has waged against Russia has failed. It would mean the effective end of that economic war. It would leave the European leadership in a catastrophic position. The entire policy that they have constructed of putting pressure against Russia will have collapsed, and it will, by the way, be the moment when President Trump, and I suspect the predominant part of the US political leadership, finally turn their backs on the fantastic demands for bone-crushing sanctions that have come from Senators Lindsey Graham and Richard Blumenthal. By the way, I noticed that Senator Blumenthal is going around complaining that this war in Iran has caused everybody to forget about his pet project, which of course remains Ukraine. The significance of any lifting of sanctions on trade in Russian oil cannot be overstated. And frankly, it would mean the effective end of Project Ukraine, and it would inevitably be understood as such by the oligarchs and various political and faction leaders which still run things in Kiev. However, that has to happen first. And it's important to stress again that though there is all this talk out there about lifting sanctions on Russian oil, nothing like that has happened so far. Perhaps it will, perhaps it won't, perhaps President Trump, trying to stabilize energy prices, is only talking about this in order to make people in the markets think that this is coming, but doesn't really intend to do it. Or perhaps he does intend to do it, but he hasn't got round to doing it yet. Again, because his objective is to stabilize energy markets. Or perhaps, especially in light of his conversation with Putin, he now feels that he needs to get Putin on side by making this quid pro quo, giving this sanctions relief to Russia, this critically important sanctions relief to Russia, in order to secure Russia's help to get him, Trump, this off-ramp with Iran. By the way, I am absolutely sure that Vladimir Putin at no point over the course of yesterday's discussion will have suggested to Trump anything like this. The Russians have a consistent policy that they have followed ever since February 2022, which is that they never bring up the topic of sanctions themselves. They only respond when their Western interlocutors do so. But anyway, just to say, if the United States does lift the sanctions, the oil sanctions on Russia, then it is the effective end of Project Ukraine. The whole premise of the sanctions war as the means to get the Russians to change their policy will have gone. It will then be accepted, admitted, that it is purely a military conflict, and without the economic pressure, I don't think anybody in Washington really believes that it can be brought, in that case, to what, from an American point of view, would be a successful end. I would just also quickly say that if the oil sanctions against Russia are indeed lifted, if attempts to restrict international trade in Russian oil are lifted, then they are never going to be put back into effect. No US administration, which has gone through the events of the last 4 years, is going to want to experiment with that kind of idea again. No US administration is going to want to risk another surge in inflation of the sort we saw in 2022. That idea will have been buried forever. Well, if that happens, if those sort of things take place, and perhaps they are more likely to than at any point since the start of the special military operation in 2022, then we can definitely say that Russia has been the big winner from the Iran war, just to say. But to repeat again, we are not there yet, and perhaps we never will be. Well, a lot of very heavy analysis in this programme. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that this is, that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.